Welcome to another episode of the Last Post radio show podcast series. You're with Greg T. Ross, and in keeping with our promise to provide interesting guests, we have Jared Archibald. Jared is a Territory History Curator at the Museum and Art Gallery of the Northern Territory, and has been in the Northern Territory, I think, or Darwin, since 1979, so there's not much he doesn't know about Darwin. Hello there, Jared.
G'day, Greg. How are you, mate?
I'm fine, and it's a pleasure having you on the radio show and a bit of a chat about what's happening at the Museum and Art Gallery of the Northern Territory. You've got an interesting exhibition coming up 7th of December. Tell us a bit about that.
Okay, so MAGNT has had a Cyclone Tracy display since 1994, and it's been well loved and visited by, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. But for this upcoming 50th anniversary, we felt that it was time for a refresh of that exhibit, and also to try and tell a whole lot more of the stories that happened. One of the reasons we've done this is the way people remember and think about Cyclone Tracy has changed over time. From, you know, the first decade, like the first 10 years, no one wanted to know about it. No one wanted to remember. No one wanted to even commemorate. It was just, we don't want to know. We want to move on. On the 20th anniversary, that began to change. People wanted to remember, but much more as a memorial type thing, rather than, you know, telling people actually what happened. So we're very cognizant of what the public want. Now on the 50th, it's changed completely. So many of the people that went through Cyclone Tracy have passed on, those who are older, and those that were much younger who've gone through, who went through it, are now, you know, in their 50s and 60s, and they have this outlook that they want to, some of them actually want to celebrate, not celebrate Cyclone Tracy, but they want to celebrate that they survived, that Darwin survived, and it's become this beautiful, you know, wonderful city of resilience and beauty, despite what happened to it 50 years ago.
Yes, and I do recall when it happened. My brother and I were in Perth, and we heard it over the radio. It remains an important part of Australia's history, and I guess that's the congratulations going to Magnet for having this as an exhibition, which starts on the 7th of December. And outlining a lot of the things that went on. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think, Jared, it wasn't seen as a particularly dangerous cyclone approaching. What happened there? There was some feeling from residents that nothing had happened or something?
Yeah, it's a little bit like that. It comes into complacency just with things that can happen and then things that just go wrong. So just a few weeks before, there'd been Cyclone Selma. So it had been warned about. It was, you know, it was to approach Darwin. That was what the forecasts were, and people got ready for it. And then it petered out. It actually turned around and went out to sea again. So Darwin didn't get much in the way of damage as such. So when you've got this happening in December, and then you've got, you know, Cyclone Tracy had been known about from about the 22nd of December, like it wasn't unknown. The people of Darwin knew about it. There'd been cyclone warnings, but it was cruising sort of southwest down the coast on the northern side of the Tiwi Islands, so a long way from Darwin. And what normally happens is cyclones in that area keep going southwest and they crash into the Kimberleys. That's just normally how they work. But on Christmas Eve morning, which is about the worst morning it could have happened, that cyclone stopped going southwest, started going south, and then went right around the corner of Bathurst Island and started coming to the southeast directly towards Darwin. So Christmas Eve is a day that people are doing other things. They're not all listening to the radio. They're not all doing the things that you would normally do on a normal weekday, because there's excitement for the next day and there's lots of preparations to be made. So most people just went, oh yeah, it'll do a Selma. We won't worry about it. It won't be a bad thing. So there was some complacency there. And I don't think it's anyone's, there's no fault there as such. It's just human nature. And Cyclone Tracy became this awful, very powerful, but very small cyclone that actually tracked right over the top of Darwin. If it had have tracked 50K to the west or the east, we would not have had anything like what happened to Darwin. But because of what it did, and it happened to, as it moved towards Darwin, it got more and more powerful. It was an extremely powerful cyclone, but a very small one. It was only, around the gale force winds, only around 50 kilometers in diameter, 50 to 75 kilometers. So,
Right.
as I say, if it had moved slightly either way and just skirted Darwin, there would not have been a damage, but everything went wrong on that day for Darwin, and it tracked directly over the top.
Jeez, when you put it like that, Jared, you can see that it seemed to have Darwin in its bullseye, didn't it?
Look, it's actually really interesting. We have had, and we will continue to have a tracking map. We can actually see it. You can watch it track down the coast and
Right.
then come around the corner of Bathurst Island, and then just basically, with a little bit of an S bend, come directly towards Darwin, just like it was aiming for it. Now, it is all random. That's not how it works. It can't do that, but it really does just head straight to Darwin and then go straight over the top.
That would have been,
Another one of the
yeah.
reasons it was so bad. Oh, sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say that would have been totally spooky because and one of the reasons why it would be a great thing to come along to the exhibition to actually see that would be spooky.
Yeah, and we actually have a on the radar plots that they were doing, it's very, very different to now, which is where it's all digitized, but they just had the cathode ray tube display for the radar. And they would actually take Polaroid camera shots of that every half hour to 45 minutes. And those exist. So we actually, as well as showing the track, show those photographs. And you can see the thing develop. It develops from a small, lower category one to a category two, and get more and more powerful. The eye forms, you get the big trailing arms, and it becomes this, excellent example of a tropical cyclone. And just as it's coming over Darwin, it's still building and it's at its most powerful. So another reason it did so much damage over Darwin was it was a slow cyclone moving across land or water. They normally go around 12K an hour, 10 to 12K an hour. This one did 6K an hour. So
Wow.
it just spent more time destroying things as it moved, which also didn't help Darwin.
Yeah, I was going to ask actually too, Jared. Of course, we all remember those that are have been on the planet long enough remember. But I guess the question from me personally is remembering the whole thing. How long did it hang around Darwin for? How long did it create this destruction and death?
Okay, it's cyclones, one of those things that build up, so it's not sort of a turn off, turn on type situation. So as it moves towards you have those outer winds that are affecting you, and then they get stronger and stronger as the cyclone comes towards you. So the really bad time was from basically midnight, around midnight, to around 4 to 5 a.m. So it's about 5 hours.
Right.
That was different for different people depending on where they were located. And many people, the eye was tracked at around 12 kilometers wide, and then when it made landfall, that shrank down to 7 to 9 kilometers wide. So much of Darwin actually had the eye pass over. So in saying that, that means that they got the worst of the winds, because the eye wall is where the most powerful winds are.
Jeez.
And once again, there's this next reason for it being so bad from a destruction point of view. If you do receive the eye, you've been have these winds build and build and build and build until they're at their worst, and then you get into the eye where it's basically still. There's no clouds, there's no rain, there's no noise, because those winds have stopped. You're in the eye, you're in the calm, but what's coming from the other side is the other side of the eye wall coming towards you.
Okay.
And many people talk about the sound of that eye wall coming towards them, and they talk about it being like a shrieking banshee, about jet engines, about 100 trucks, about
Wow.
just something they can't describe. And
Wow.
you go from that calm to basically instantaneous, the worst winds, the most powerful, but from the other direction, because it's spinning in a clockwise rotation. So everything has been weakened one way. So houses, trees, all those sorts of things have been weakened by the winds hitting them from one direction, all get hit from the other direction at full power, instantaneous. And that's when so much more damage was done, because
Jeez.
everything had been weakened one way, and then it gets hit full on from the other direction.
Geez, your description is so, I tell you what, it knocks your socks off when you think of the power of nature when you describe it like that too, Jared. And I'm almost there. You can almost feel that and that anticipation waiting for the wall to approach and hearing that sound. It was incredible. So actually, I suppose you say between midnight and between 5 a.m. on Christmas Day.
Around about, yes.
Yeah, so I guess we look at the destruction and the deaths. There was, I guess, two sailors died, didn't they? Petty Officer Leslie Calton, I think, and Able Seaman Ian Rennie. Were they actually on board the HMAS Arrow when the cyclone hit?
Yes, so there were four patrol boats in Darwin Harbour at the time.
Hmm.
They all went to special cyclone moorings that had been put in place. But by about midnight, 1 o'clock, all of them were basically the seas were so bad that they were beginning to tear the anchor winches out of the bows. Like it was
Jeez.
really, really bad. They were being pounded. So all of them either they broke away or left their moorings and tried to get out to sea. Because they were actually dragging the concrete clumps that were in the mud, so dragging it with the ships. So the cyclone moorings just weren't good enough, not at all. Although they'd been designed to be that, it's just yet in that cyclone they couldn't do their job. So two ships managed to get out to sea with damage, but the Arrow didn't. So Captain Dagworthy with his 18 crew. They were in the harbour. They had broken away from their mooring, and he had decided the ships. When you read the after incident reports, it's unbelievable. They're talking about ships rolling to 80 degrees one way, then the other way, and dipping their navigation lights in the water. Like just even just imagining what it's like to be in a ship that's rolling, basically on its side and then rolling back the other way,
My
and you're
God.
trying to also keep that ship into the wind. So they were having lots of problems mechanically, just from the point of view they had to keep those engines going, otherwise they'd be broadside to the ocean, and that's when you die. You can capsize and all things go wrong. But the water intakes for the cooling water at the bottom of the hull, but the hulls, that the ship is heeling so far over, they began sucking air. Most of the ships reported that. So the engines start overheating. So you can't cook the engines because then they're dead anyway. And the other problem they were having was the oil pressure alarms and then shutoff systems were going off because the oil intakes for the engines were sucking air instead of oil. And so engineers were trying to manually flick those back so they could restart engines and keep those engines going because they knew if the engine stopped, they were then at the mercy of the sea. So Captain Dagworthy had decided with his engines overheating that he was going to run his ship aground in Francis Bay. So that's a bay with a creek in it, has lots of mangroves either side. He just thought he'd run it aground in the mud, in the mangroves, and try and save his ship and crew. As he was attempting to do that, the ship was pushed into the corner of Stokes Hill Wharf, the main wharf. And that was, once again, when you read about that, it was a shocking experience for all because you've got massive seas pushing a large ship into a wharf that's immovable.
Oh,
And
God.
so it's actually smashing the ship, but the ship is actually smashing the wharf as well. So
Oh,
men
geez.
were trying to, they all had their, it was, when you read about it, it's a shocking experience. They all had their life preservers on. And they were trying to, as the ship came up on the waves, were then trying to jump onto the wharf. Some managed to do that, some didn't. Some were swept into the sea. And, Catton and Rennie were killed. And Captain Dagworthy, and he was the last off the ship. He actually, in the end, he couldn't get up onto the wharf. And he had a life preserver on, and he jumped into the sea and was swept through the wharf and was swept to the shore.
Gee.
But not just as an easy thing, but very battered, very scratched up from going through the pylons that are covered in oysters. So yeah, it just a shocking,
Wow.
shocking thing. And then the ship sank. So yeah, it was
Wow.
the only naval Australian naval ship lost to a natural disaster.
Well, there should be a film about that. I mean, maybe, and I plead my ignorance, maybe something has been done, like as a documentary or something, but I see this as being such a moment, Jared. That's incredible, your description of that.
Yeah, it's just so many people went through so many different things, but being on the harbour was probably, I think, the worst place could be. Not just for the patrol boats, there were a large number of fishing trawlers, there were ferries, there were work boats, pilot boats, all sorts of things. Like, yeah, there was a schooner called the Booyah. It was lost for 29 years. Like, it was 150 feet long, gone. And no one knew where it was. Five people on board, and those remains were never found. The ship was found in
God.
2003,
Only
and
in
one of the other large
2003.
ships. Yep, it took 30 years for that. Oh, sorry, 29 years, and then 30 years. The next year, they found the Darwin Princess, which was a very large ferry that was nearby. So those are the two larger ships that were sunk. But were lost, and no remains have been found from them. Although the police divers, when they were found, were able to recover off the Booyah some personal effects, and they were able to then the coroner then reopened the cases of the missing at sea. When you have no body and no wreck, it's the coroners, they can't just say, you're dead, because there's no proof. But once a wreck was found, he was able to then change, the verdict of missing at sea to death at sea for the five on the Booyah and the one on the Darwin Princess.
It's an incredible thing when you look at it. I guess too, the cleanup. I mean, I guess Darwin would have been in shock for some time on Christmas Day, but how long did it take for the cleanup to be organized?
It's actually really interesting. But lots of different things happen. I think one of the things you can take away from any disaster, not just Darwin and Cyclone Tracy, but when any big major disaster happens, it brings out the best in some people, and it sometimes brings out the worst in others. But mostly, people do things that they didn't think they could. I'm just trying to, in a way that they become leaders. They assist. They go, look, I can help here. I can actually do something here that will make a difference. So one of the first things that I've found out a lot about was by the end of Christmas Day, basically the roads, most of the roads, and we're talking about major roads right through the suburbs and Darwin City, had been cleared, and that was with fellas who jumped on large front end loaders and just basically ran around. The entire town and the suburbs, clearing tin and debris and everything just off the roads, because everyone talks about on that Christmas Day, once they'd come out of the wreckage and seen that their neighbors, seen to their neighbors and that people are okay, they then wanted to go to family or friends in other suburbs or get to their workplace, like the police or nurses or doctors, to the hospital. But it took so long to be able to do that. The two reasons: one, so much debris on the roads. With lots of also nails sticking out, so lots of tire punctures and stuff. But also, people report they couldn't recognize where to go. Like it doesn't sound like that's right. But when you've lost all your street signs, you've lost all your vegetation, you've lost all the normal landmarks that you're used to, although the
Jeez.
roads are still there. People say that it was very difficult, especially in suburbs, to find out where they were, because everything they were used to wasn't the same. And many people talk about being able to see the ocean from from inland suburbs, which you could never do. And now, 50 years later, you definitely can't do. You cannot see the ocean from many suburbs because of tropical vegetation in gardens. So that was sort of the very beginning, but people
The points of
really,
reference were gone, Jared. The points of reference were gone for a
yes,
lot of
that's it.
people.
Absolutely. And so there wasn't much cleanup on Christmas Day apart from people, just trying to find, if they could, valuables. But people weren't even worried about valuables. They were just looking for food and shelter. And many people congregated in each of the suburbs. There was a primary school, And those primary schools stood up very well. They were damaged, but they weren't damaged to the same extent that people's homes were. So they became these gathering centres, and people within those, many survivors then started organising people into, okay, I need you people to go and dig a latrine, because there was no water, no power, no sewerage, there was nothing. So we need a latrine dug here. We need you people to go into fridges, because the fridges had all gone off, but the food was still okay. I need you to go get food and bring it here. People looking after cooking and doing that. So they actually, and some people were far more in shock and weren't able to help themselves, but others were able to then assist them. And there became these communities based in the schools and other government buildings. And that happened for the first few days. And then things started to get organized. People came out of their shock. And also the authorities started to being able to, organize things on a larger scale.
Incredible stuff. And of course, I guess just harking back to that immediate the immediate aftermath of the Cyclone Tracy, where you talk about the human condition and for all of us, we sometimes wonder, don't we, Jared, if we would be able to assume these positions of leadership or care or enact help in the way that some of these brilliant people do. And it's almost superhuman, but of course, it's in us all, I guess, but it's always amazing thing to see.
Yeah, and I do need to state right now, all these things I'm saying not from experience. I did not go through Cyclone Tracy. I just want to make that clear for anyone that may be listening. But I have spoken over the past, 45 years. I've spoken to lots and lots of people that have and done lots of research. So I am speaking on behalf of people, but not from experience. But with that point you're making, yes, it really you see these people who are just ordinary people who then become leaders. They're just natural leaders. They just haven't been put in that position before, and so they're the ones that are able to think things through, see the bigger picture, and go, "This is what we need," and I can now organize other people to assist to make those things happen. Because some, and not everyone's a leader, but there's a lot of people who, once they're told what to do, will just go to and do it. And they're just as important, because you need the workers as well as the leaders. And so, as these teams formed, it became, people were helping each other. That was one of the big things from Cyclone Tracy.
No, incredible. And as you said right at the beginning too, you see facets of human nature that are brilliant and facets that are not so so likely to be the negative side. So yeah, incredible stuff. Major General Alan Stretton was appointed leader. You've got a bit on Alan at the exhibition too?
Yeah, we have some. There's so many stories and so many things that we need to talk about. He is just one of those, but he is a pivotal figure. So he was the leader of the newly formed Australian Disasters Organisation, and this was basically the baptism of fire. They had not had a major disaster, and then this one happened. So Major Stretton, Major General Stretton, was sent to Darwin. He got here very late, Christmas Day, very late in the evening. And it's actually interesting. I'm going to say, as well as being pivotal, he's also a figure that many love and many don't like as much. And I'm just being careful there. In some of his books, he tends to say things that get some people's backs up. But just moving on from that, he had, or from the government, was given basically ultimate power and authority. So when decisions were made, he could actually then say, "Make this happen," and it happened. And one of the biggest decisions that was made, and it was made as a committee. So there was a fellow called Dr. Charles Gird. He was the NT medical officer. And he said, and he'd been in other places in Africa and in the Pacific where he'd been in disasters before. He said, "We have 45,000 people that have no power, water, sewage, or shelter, and this is a recipe for disaster, for disease, for a lot of things going wrong." And he recommended reducing the population of Darwin down to around 10,000 from that 45,000, so around three quarters to leave. That was his recommendation, and Stretton said, "Make it happen, do it." And he had the authority to make that happen and to have both the defense forces and the civilian airlines assist in making that so, and had the backing of the government. The government said, "We'll look after these people. We will give them emergency money." One of the really interesting things with the evacuation is that it was not a forced evacuation. No one was forced to go. They were encouraged strongly, I've got to say that, but they were all offered a return airfare as well when the time was right. It wasn't, "You're out and you're not coming back. This is, we need you out because we need to be able to focus on the cleanup, and there's just no shelter for you. There's no food, and it'll be very difficult until the place is cleaned up and power's back on and so forth." So they were at pains to say, that this is, it's voluntary, but many, many people did just want to leave. Darwin was not their home. They were here for work and they wanted to go back home to their homes in the southern states. Many, many Darwin people were quite upset. They didn't want to be taken away from Darwin. They didn't want to leave, but just the conditions didn't warrant being able to keep them here. So many did stay, obviously around 10,000, and most of those were men, but there were a lot of women and some kids stayed. I've talked to a number of families where whole families did stay because their home was habitable, and they had shelter, and they were using their swimming pool water to flush toilets. And one of the young fellas I talked to, he is now an ex-politician, but he was 7 years old, and he actually says that that time in Darwin after Cyclone Tracy, I'm going to get a little bit emotional. He said that it was one of the best times for him and his family because they came together and they played games around the table. They worked hard. They cleared up their home. He assisted his father in making things better, like doing repairs and things. And he remembers it as, it was a shocking time, but an actual good time. Now that isn't the experience of everyone, but
Oh, no, I
that's
can
just what he
understand it.
remembers as a 7-year-old.
That's interesting you say that too, Jared, because, of course, in times of tragedy and disaster, whether it be personal or on a grand scale like Cyclone Tracy hitting Darwin, there is moments of great intimacy and closeness.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
But you have the other side too. It also, especially the evacuation, it tore families apart. And there was a lot of families that didn't survive from the point of view of relationships didn't survive because of the stresses from what they went through, but then being torn apart, dads and that staying here, and then mums and kids moving south. It was a really difficult time for all, and some didn't make it through. Relationships didn't, they suffered badly.
I tell you what, I can understand that too, totally. And some you've got a couple, one may want to stay, one may want to go, and that's the end of that. And then, of course, that ricochets, and that would have been seen on many scale, on a big scale throughout the build, the cleanup, and the decisions on whether to return to Darwin or not. But look, a pivotal and historic moment in Australia's history. And Jared, you've been fantastic. Jared Archibald, Territory and History Curator at Magnet Museum Art Gallery of Northern Territory, with the exhibition on Cyclone Tracy starting on the 7th of December. So get up there and have a look at it. We're coming up at some stage. I'll tell you what, we're going to have a look at this. And your discussion's been fantastic, Jared. So we thank you very much on behalf of the Last Post Radio Show.
No problem. Thank you.
You're listening to Greg T. Ross and the Last Post Radio Show.